A year ago, I was, actually, I don't even know what I was doing. I know I was doing something useful, worthwhile, and functional, and I received a phone call in the middle of the day from someone who was attending Faith Builders Teachers Week. And the caller inquired, "Would it be all right to submit your name as a suggested speaker next year?" He queried. "Sure," I quipped. Since that time, I've had quite a few occasions to speak or hear others speak. I heard their quips, some quaint, some quotable, some questionable. I noticed various quirks and thought, how queer are those quirks? Well, guess what? This happened to me type of story. Just the other day, my daughter, my own flesh and blood daughter, actually had the intestinal fortitude to point out some quips and quirks that she considered queer about me, about a topic, a talk that I had just given. She said, "Daddy, you use the words indeed and perhaps too much." And I thought, indeed. I use indeed quite often, perhaps too often. "And Daddy, why do you kind of stiff your arms in front of you when you're speaking? And did you know you were scratching in your ear a lot and tugging on your nose?" My wife said I need to stop that because it's long enough. Anyway, now I'm in a quandary because I got the hibby-jibbies, otherwise known as qualms, because I'm supposed to talk about stuff like this. Is this a quagmire or what? What about some of these quips? How many of you have heard of Heather Whitestone? She was Miss America 1995. In her interview, prior to being nominated and the judges considering her, she, along with all the other contestants from every state in our union, were asked this question. She was asked this question: if you could live forever, would you, and why? Here was Miss America 1995's answer. "I would not live forever, because we should not live forever. Because if we were supposed to live forever, then we would live forever. But we cannot live forever, which is why I would not live forever." Profound. Or about the how about the quip by the nervous teenage girl when she was making expression prior to communion and preparatory service of her peace with God? She said this: "I have peace with God and all my men." Now, someone once said that that giving a speech is an art. It's the art of making deep noises from the chest that sound like important messages from the brain. Maybe you've heard of some quips worth mentioning. Anything come to your mind that somebody said they just kind of goofed up and the quips just weren't worth quoting? Anybody? All right, let's move on. Yeah. Okay.
He was trying to help the third world. Uh-huh.
There's a lot the United States can do to help a third world war. Yeah. There was a prominent, basketball player who, when he was being interviewed by the press after knee surgery, he said, "I never had knee surgery anywhere else on my body." How about these quirks? picking or pulling on the nose, or those little itchy, nervous areas on your face, or how about when you're coming up to the podium, you just kind of look at it as it's kind of some kind of strange beast. and ambling along, perhaps without purpose. Someone calls it desultory, which means without purpose or meaning, and just coming up to it as, you know, I don't have any business being there. Or, you ever seen this? Back and forth. About hypnotizes you. Or like this, tiptoeing, walking, tiptoeing up and down like that, or hugging the lectern. You know, these strange grunts. I have one young man that I know of that when he's nervous and when he's getting ready to have devotions in church, I can know who is going to have devotions, because he goes like that, you know, sitting in the pews. That's what he does. He's getting ready for this thing, you know. I guess he's just that's that adrenaline just blowing out of his nose. Okay, you know, or these things of I'm making a point and I'm just looking at one person, just. You feel comfortable? Yeah, those kind of things. And you name it. What are some other things that you've noticed that speakers do, or perhaps you do, or tend to do when you're nervous or excited or have that adrenaline rush? Thought of anything else? Yeah, wringing of hands. There you go. That's a good one. All right. Any others? And you probably noticed a few with me already. I don't think a speaker is hardly immune to it. Very few speakers won't have some quirk of some kind. How about using the word or repetitious words like you know or you know, like that. Okay? Well, that leads us to the qualms part. When you might have read in the introduction to this workshop that, according to a recent poll, most Americans would prefer death over public speaking. I mean, really, you know, if you deduct that down to its literal meaning, most Americans would rather be up front here in a coffin than behind the lectern. And I've read that poll several times, and that's the conclusion. I mean, it's worse than falling sick, and all, you know, anything else bad that could happen to a person. The worst thing that can happen to many Americans is they have to speak in public. Well, we want to discuss gaining confidence, using fear for effectiveness, and I want to share with you what I consider the top secret for overcoming fear. And concerning quagmires, we're talking about just real problems in communication. Some real don'ts. We'll address some of these too. But really, the title, Quips, Quirks, Qualms, and Quagmires, is just basically a catchy title to bring you into the workshop. We won't really necessarily be talking about quips, quirks, qualms, and quagmires in that order per se, but we'll just discuss what it encompasses. Now, communication issues. Now, we're not going to be talking only about public speaking. Most of what I'll say and share will pertain most, maybe perhaps directly to speaking in public, but it's applicable to any kind of conversation or communication. As teachers, you know, we have lots of ways to communicate. You may need to be in front of the class, you're sharing in devotions. You may need to be privately explaining something to a student. You may need to be disciplining a student in private and talking to him about his need and asking for a proper response. Whatever the issue, most of these principles should apply to almost any kind of communication. But there are issues in communication. For example, when any two persons communicate, there is what you wanted to say, what you meant to say, and what you said, and what you think you said, and what the other person heard you say, what the other person thinks he heard you say, and what the other person thinks you meant to say, and what the other person feels about what you said, and what the other person says about what you said, and what you think the other person said or will say about what you said. We have these issues. It's kind of complicated. But as I mentioned, that public speaking is not the only communication style. Ecclesiastes 12:11 says this, and I was just blessed when I found this verse last evening as I was looking at some scriptures. The words of the wise are as goads, and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. Now, a goad is something that stimulates to action. The words of the wise are as goads. They stimulate to action. They energize. And they move people. They move the audience. They move the hearers. The words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened, piercing deep, driven into, to hang something on. They make a deep impression upon the memory and conscience and serve for the regulation of life. Nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, teachers of God's people, you and me, as teachers or any kind of communicator, teachers of people, masters of assemblies, from one shepherd, God, the good shepherd, the one great shepherd. The words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. Ecclesiastes 12:11. Number one, you are more than a teacher. You are a communicator of truth. You are a communicator of truth. You're more than a teacher. We are teachers, but we are more than a teacher. You're a communicator of truth. One of the themes I had one year in our classroom as an overriding, year-long theme was, buy the truth and sell it not. Buy the truth and sell it not. And that's a prayer I pray for my children often, that they hear me pray this, that they would purchase the truth but never sell it. Share it, talk about it, give it away, but never sell it. Never dispose of it. Never sell it. The buying, the purchasing of truth, and as teachers, we are communicators of the truth that we have purchased. And the truth that we have purchased as buyers of the truth is the truth that set us free, and it can set your students free. Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. You want your students to be free. We are communicators of the truth that sets them free. All truth is God's truth. So when we share a truth, whether it's an academic truth, or if it's a truth from the scriptures, or a truth from life experience, or just the wisdom of your heart and experience, it's a truth that will set free, because truth is freeing. So we are more than a teacher. You're a communicator of truth, and that truth frees the person to be who they should be. It's therefore incumbent upon us that we think on and speak on truth. Truth. Okay, number two there. Look at the five things there, and let's see if you can place them in order of what you think is the order of importance. How you say it, what you say, who you are, how it's received, and why you say it. Go ahead and list them in the order of importance that you think they should be. Place them in order of importance for effective communication. I'll give you just a couple seconds to do that. And then we'll discuss it. Number one being most important. What are you putting down for number one? who you are. How many agree? Okay, very well. What are you putting down for number two? Okay, let's see. Yes, why you say it. How many agree? Okay, some, maybe not all. Okay, what do you put down for number three? There could be some variation from here on. Okay, how you say it rates pretty high. How many of you place that as number three? Okay, a number of you. Okay, what about number four? How it's received. How many of you put that down? Okay, a few. All right. How many of you put down for number four what you say? Okay. How many of you put for number five what you say? Okay, thank you. This is just opinion. It's a 10-cent opinion. But if you agree with me, it becomes a dollar. Okay. I believe that number one is who you are. Who you are is the most important aspect of effective communication. I believe that number two is why you say what you say. The motive. What's your motive? Can you ever feel sometimes that someone has a certain motive for why they're saying what they're saying? And it might not be quite above par, or he may not be really stating why he's saying it, but you kind of get the feeling that there's a reason for it, you know. Yeah, I think why you say it ranks really high as to what is your motivation? Why do you say this? And why do you want to say it? Number three could be how you say it. My wife hates, she doesn't hate our dogs, but she hates them when they're in the flower bed. Okay, and I can go out to the dogs when I step out the door, and if they're in the flower bed, I can say something, "Good dog!" And they'll jump up and get out, you know. But if I can say, "Good dog," their tails wag and they come to me, you know. And just an illustration that, you know, how you say what you say. If you come across as harsh and critical, you know, the truth isn't freeing. It puts you in a defensive position. So I put number three down for how you say it. Number four, how it's received. How does the audience receive it? Those two are closely linked because of how you say it depends a lot on how it's received. And then number five is maybe what you say. I suppose that could be quibbled. You could discuss the various aspects of, you know, in what order they do rank of importance. But I want to emphasize especially the number one, and I think we have general agreement on that, is that the number one for effectiveness in, number one in importance for effectiveness in our communication is who you are. Because who you are comes out through what you say. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. Jesus said it, and there's many other places in Scripture that it's illustrated, well illustrated, that what's in our heart, what's your character, flows out. And it's obvious to all. And I've already said that, and I honestly believe it, especially in our classrooms, is when our students, or if our students, don't suspect or feel that you're genuine or real, that's unforgivable. They can forgive almost anything except hypocrisy. But if they sense that you're real and genuine, they can trust you and receive what you have to say. So your walk with God, your relationship with the Lord Jesus comes out. It's exemplified in what you say. So who you are really, the bottom line, the fundamental issue in effectiveness in communication, whether it's public speaking or interacting one-on-one or whatever other form of communication there might be, the bottom line, the bottom issue, the fundamental question is, who are you? Who are you? Are you who God says you are? Do your students know you as God knows you? Because who you are comes out, it becomes evident. So who you are is infinitely more important than what you say and how you say, because character and motive are the two chief carriers for effectiveness in communication. I want to take a look now at three life-changing sermons. The first sermon recorded in the Scripture is what? I'm talking about in the New Testament, I'm sorry. Sermon on the Mount. You could say perhaps John the Baptist, but those, it's not a sermon recorded necessarily. But the recorded sermon, the first recorded sermon in the New Testament is the Sermon on the Mount. Do you know that sermon, if what's recorded in the Scriptures is all that Jesus said, it was about 15 minutes. But consider the life-changing import of what Jesus spoke. He spoke with authority. He spoke with authority. Matthew 7:28. After Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. He finished up by giving a closing example of the wise man who built his house on the rock and the foolish man who built his house on the sand. And when he was all done with everything he had said, the people were just astonished at his doctrine. Mouth open. Heart change. Life-changing truths had been spoken. He spoke with authority. He spoke with authority and not as the scribes. Adam Clark said this about the Sermon on the Mount. Thus ends a sermon the most strict, pure, holy, profound, and sublime ever delivered to man, and yet so amazingly simple is the whole that almost a child may apprehend it. Did you also catch that it said that his sermon wasn't as the scribes? History would tell us that when the scribes preached a sermon spoke in public, they had the driest, dullest collection of disjointed comments upon every conceivable problem in the history of mankind. The scribes quoted the rabbis before them and were afraid to express an idea without bolstering up by some predecessor. Jesus spoke with the authority and freshness of truth. Folks, truth is always fresh, and truth carries its own authority. Truth carries its own authority. Jesus spoke the truth. Therefore, he spoke with authority. Jesus spoke with the authority of truth, the reality of fresh and freshness of the morning light, and the power of God's Spirit. Jesus spoke with authority. The next sermon, I guess you could say a sermon, at least the next sermon that's recorded, you could say is Peter. Peter's sermon in Acts 2:14 is where it begins, on the day of Pentecost. Peter spoke with boldness. He spoke with boldness. Peter, standing up with the 11. Can you just imagine 12 men standing up? Remember, there was a lot of confusion here. There was flames of fire standing above certain people's heads, and there was a lot of strange talk and languages being given out at the same time. And all of a sudden, 12 men stand up. And Peter steps forward. I can just picture him stepping forward and begin to speak with boldness what he says. And the reason I say boldness is because the next thing says, the next phrase is, standing up with the 11, lifted up his voice. There was a lot of clamor and a lot of things going on. He spoke with boldness and courage to get above the din and the clamor of what was going on. And then he spoke with courage and boldness and vigor. An amazing sermon. 3,000 people respond to his 5-minute sermon. And yield their lives in submission to following Jesus. 3,000. Peter spoke with boldness. The next sermon that's recorded is Stephen's sermon. It's a sermon that got him executed. says that the audience was not able to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which he spoke. He spoke with wisdom and sincerity. Spoke with wisdom and sincerity. And he was irresistible. He had a spirit of zeal and sincerity which they could not withstand. Mr. Barnes says, the evidence of sincerity, honesty, and zeal in a public speaker will often go farther to convince the masses of mankind than the most able argument if delivered in a cold and indifferent manner. Stephen spoke with sincerity. He spoke with wisdom. Now I have a question. These three sermons, life-changing sermons, did they appeal primarily to the audience's emotion or primarily to the audience's reason? What do you think?
Reason.
Exactly. Somehow we get the idea sometimes, don't we, that an effective speech has to be a tearjerker. You know, get them to cry. You've done something great. An effective talk. Get them to cry. How many of you have heard of a lady named Peggy Noonan? Perhaps you have. Don't know who she is. She is the unsung hero behind one of the greatest communicators in America's history, Ronald Reagan. She was his speechwriter. And I have a book written by her on speaking, public speaking, although it's not applicable necessarily to everything that we deal with today because she's a speech writer for others. Here's what she had to say about appealing to emotion or to logic. She says that effective speeches appeal primarily to the logic and secondarily to the emotion. And Ronald Reagan was called the great communicator. And that was partly at least because of Peggy Noonan appealing to the logic. He would tell her what he wanted to convey, and she would write it out in a logical way, which, by the way, is very significant for a woman to write in a logical way and to give it to a man to say, and he'll follow it without major adaptations. It's very significant. Okay, a few more scriptural considerations for qualities for effective communication. Matthew 5:37, Jesus said, let your communication be yea, second time if you have to, nay, again, nay, if you must, whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. Okay, concise. It's a quality of effective communication. Jesus said it must be that way. Be concise. Yes. No. Number two, Colossians 4:6. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that ye may know how ye ought to answer every man. Proverbs 22:11. He that loveth pureness of heart for the grace of his lips, the king will be his friend. Ecclesiastes 10:12, the words of a wise man's mouth are gracious. It's the second quality there, Colossians 4:6. Gracious. It's a quality of effective communication. Being tactful, being gracious. The words delivered and the things you want to say delivered in a way that is appealing, not harsh, not a verbal spanking. Gracious. Appealing, tactful. Titus 2:8, sound speech that cannot be condemned. Proverbs 10:32, the lips of the righteous know what is acceptable. Sound speech, that is, It's a quality of effective communication, soundness, healthy speech, true, right. It's what we're talking about when we talk about sound, that it's healthy, it's wholesome, it's upbuilding, it's right and true. And finally, 1 Peter 3:15, but sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. That answer, I love this. It's something that I've been challenged with over and over again as I consider what Peter is really saying, what the scriptures are really saying here. Be ready always to give an apologia. You've heard of apologetics? Same word. Be ready always to give a reasoned, defensible answer. Not the answer of, well, it's the way we've done it, it's what our church believes, but a reasoned, defensible answer, an apologia. Our speech should be reasoned. Should be reasoned and defensible. It should, and then it also says mild. What is the most convincing argument when you're doing an apologia to someone that is asking you a reason for the hope that lieth within you? Is it the answer that comes across as saying, oh, everybody else has it wrong, we have it right? No, it's the meekness. It's the meek answer. It's the meek apologia. It's the answer that says, here is the way I understand the scriptures. Here are the issues that this addresses. And without being attackive, confrontational, you can give a meek apologia. And then not only meek, but it says also respectful, or in meekness and, what does it say? Meekness and fear, or reverence, respect. Respect the individual and recognize that perhaps he has a different viewpoint or worldview. So, reasoned, mildness, and respect. Winston Churchill is renowned as an able communicator. Winston Churchill and Ronald Reagan rank very closely together in how people perceive them, and as history will record, their aptness to communicate. Both of them said some very famous and life-changing things. Made a huge impact on their audiences, whether it was to other world leaders or to just a general public, or whether it was just to their nation. Winston Churchill was an able orator, but he once asked a man whom he considered his speech father, if you please. His name was Bourke Cochrane. He once asked him what he believes is the secret of eloquence. Bourke Cochrane said just a few words. He said this, believing in what you're talking about. The number one secret of effective communication is sincerity. The number one quality of effective communication, I believe, is sincerity. If you're sincere, you really deeply believe about two things, what you're saying and about the audience. The audience will only be convinced when they sense that you care deeply about what you're saying and about them. A sincerity. You see, it's not about me. It's not. It's not about me. It's not about getting people to say nice things about me or to gain the applause of men or any other less than noble reason why public speakers will do what they do. It's about the audience. And you must care deeply about what you're saying and about the audience. And those two coupled together are powerful. The number one quality of effective communication is sincerity. Proverbs 10:21 says, the lips of the righteous feed many. And what an opportunity you have when you're in front of your classroom and the many 11 or 12 students that you have. The many, that if you're in front of the church giving a talk or a devotions or a topic or a message, the lips of the righteous feed many. They feed their heart, feed their soul, feed their future, life-changing. The mouth of a righteous man is a well of life. It's a well of life. Now, do you think that the Apostle Paul was an effective communicator? Yes. Unqualified, yes, right? Did he consider himself that way? No. Unqualified, no. He thought, he considered himself as much, much less than eloquent. In fact, he considered himself inferior. And I, brethren, when I came to you, came not with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God. For I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. He was sincere. He had no personal ambition when he was speaking. The only thing he wanted to know was Jesus Christ. That's what he wanted the audience to know. Jesus Christ and him crucified. He says, I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my speech and my preaching were not with enticing words, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. Sincerity is just written all over this. That your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Related to sincerity is utter selflessness, like the Apostle Paul, and a preoccupation with God's glory. A preoccupation with God's glory. Can you be preoccupied with God's glory as you're teaching in the classroom? As you're giving a lesson? Can you be preoccupied with the glory of God? Okay, some do's and don'ts of quirks and quagmires. We may not belabor all of these, but I want to take a look at some of them at least. Do use vivid words and adjectives, but appropriate. Would it be appropriate to, you want to just spice up a little bit of how you want to tell somebody that their meal was delicious? Good and delicious, tasty. Maybe they're too worn out. So you want to find another word. So how about Mrs. Hirschberger, this spaghetti is vivacious. No. Use appropriate words. I mean, what's she going to picture? She's going to picture those spaghetti noodles starting to wiggle and squirm and crawl off the plate. They're vivacious, going all over the plate and moving out of there. You might not want to say things like, use colorful words and vivid picture words, but you might not want to say things like, Stephen, your essay was pregnant with enthusiasm. What's going to be the next thing he'll say? What do you mean? Or he might say, our cat's expecting babies, and you've gotten completely off the subject. And so, use appropriate words, but resort to some more vivid things. It captures the heart. It captures their feelings and brings them in. Do be aware of noise and distractions. When I talk about noise, I'm referring to about other things that might be going on, perhaps just in their mind, perhaps in their memory. But it could be in reality, too. It could be just something that they're dealing with physically or subtly in their mind. Just be aware of it. There's lots of noise and clutter going on. And what your student may be hearing or tempted to hear instead of what you're saying is the bird singing in the window outside the bush. He may be hearing that vehicle going down the road, and he wonders if Dad's going to the doctor or if he's coming back. There's a lot of noise, a lot of distractions that can be going on. But then there's physical distractions that can be going on in the classroom too, such as a student not paying attention. How do you deal with that? Deal and manage and minimize distractions. I taught in an individualized classroom for most of my, all my years really. And so about the only time that I had to be up front and actually give a talk or a lecture would be devotions. And I tried to make those interesting and capturing and life-changing. But occasionally a student would be distracted. He'd be looking out the side or looking down or something like that. What can you do about those kinds of things? Manage and minimize those types of things where students aren't paying attention. One thing you can do is kind of weave that person into your story talk about, I wonder how do you think Conrad would deal with that? And Conrad's the one that's just maybe not paying attention quite like he could should be. Just subtle and little ways like that to kind of wake them up and bring them back in with you. It might be that you'd have to just kind of step to the side and just kind of subtly stand in front of Conrad as you're talking. Just kind of, and then just give him a little nudge or something like that. You know, subtle little things, if you please. Manage and minimize those distractions, because if what you're saying is important, it's also important for them to listen. You know, Jesus talked about the distractions. When the word is being spoken, when truth is being spoken, and seed is being sown, some of it lands by the wayside. The birds of the air come pick it up. And he says, that's Satan. That's Satan coming and picking up the word and make so it's not going to be even sprout and be fruitful. Okay? So minimize those distractions. Deal with them creatively. See, do be brief and to the point. The recipe for a good speech includes some shortening. President Reagan believed that no speech should last longer than 20 minutes. No speech should last longer than 20 minutes. He believed that if it couldn't be said in 20 minutes, it probably wasn't even worth saying. Use short sentences. Short sentences can be much more easily digested than long, rambling sentences that go back and forth and you try to keep up with it, especially for children. Keep it short. Keep the sentences short and coherent. One of my pet peeves is when a speaker gets up for Sunday morning devotions and he chooses a text and he begins to read and he stumbles all over the words. And when he heard that someone did this just recently, that when he came to a list of names in the text that he had chosen, he said, he was reading up through there, and when he got to those names, he said, and I'll leave it up to you to interpret those. And he skipped all the way over them and moved on in the text. You know, if you choose a text, there should be a reason for it. It's the text that you're going to be building off of. And so it's important to read it beforehand. Make sure you can pronounce all the words properly. And then read with proper inflection and emphasis. Brother Irvin Hershberger is someone that I greatly admired in the way he could speak and be effective. And when I was a student in one of his classes in Bible school, I heard him say one time that when he is getting ready to preach a sermon, he will make sure he reads the text at least 10 times before he reads it in public. He'll go over the text at least 10 times so that he can know where he wants to read an emphasis. If you introduce what you're going to be saying by reading a text, by the time you're finished, the audience should have a pretty good idea of what you're going to be talking about because of your emphasis points in the text, because of your word inflections, by how you pronounce this word or how you kind of come out with it, you know. So by the time you get finished reading a text, you should have a pretty good idea of what the speaker is going to be talking about. So read with proper inflection and emphasis and do it prior to reading it publicly. E, don't be ambiguous, whatever that means. Ambiguity. It could mean this. It could mean this. It's up to you to guess. The vagueness. Use clear, concise words. Be perspicuous. That's a word that I didn't even know until recently. Perspicuous means clear and comprehensible. Clearly expressed and therefore easily understood. I was working on an administrative team when we were serving at Hillcrest Home, and In working with issues, sometimes I would hear someone say, okay, I'll tell them this. I'll deal with this, and I'll tell them this and that. And when I heard him tell them this, it was neither this nor that. And it kind of leaves them hanging and guessing what he really wanted to say. What did he mean? So beware of ambiguity. Don't be ambiguous. Be perspicuous. Yeah, use the power of questions. They're powerful. That's one thing. Jesus is a master teacher. He was a master communicator, although he never had any, you know, formal education in this. He was a master communicator, and one of the things he used prolifically was questions. Whom then do men say that I am? What did Moses say in the law? He would sometimes use rhetorical questions. Sometimes introducing a subject, he would ask a question. And he used the power of questions. Questions gets people's minds engaged and thinking and brought into it. And it's not offensive. It's easy and calm. It's what they can live with, questions. G, do look the audience in the eyes. If I'm speaking back there and, you know, you want to pay attention to me, I may be making a good point, but who's really looking at me? And surely they're getting it, but I'm speaking way back there. You know, do look the audience in the eyes. Not to pierce and gaze, as I mentioned before. I've already been in an audience where it seemed that the speaker fixed on me. And, oh, what do? Your eyes drop. That's the way I used to do. I had to try to avoid or try to get him off of me, and often that'll work. If he starts to gaze at me or stare a person down, just try that sometimes. Just drop your eyes and, you know, pay a little attention. He'll find someone else to fix his eyes on, and often that's the case. And do look deeply in eyes as you are a communicator, as you're communicating, but don't be shifty. Don't, you know, just moving around constantly. Be deliberate. You know, look in the eyes if you have something worthwhile saying, and if you want them to listen to you, speak to the eyes. The eyes communicate. And it also tells the speaker, it also tells you as a teacher, as a communicator of truth, it also says how it's being received. The eyes speak volumes. If their eyes are wide open and looking at you, it says something. You're doing a good job. But if they're kind of daydreaming, a little lazy, and kind of going off somewhere else, you can tell right then where they're going and where you are. So be a student of the eyes. Reddy talked about how to approach the lectern, you know, the ambling, the dragging, and looking at the lectern like it may be something, just a big rough beast that you don't want to, that you want it to attack you. I, draw in the audience with a well-thought-through attention step followed by introductions. I won't belabor this or talk about it much, but an attention step, the beginning words are so important to bring them into it and kind of engage their minds with imagination or real thoughts right away. If you're having a grammar class and you need to introduce or talk about adjectives today, how appealing would it be to your students to say, "Class, today we're going to talk about adjectives." Oh, no. Another one of those parts of speech. How appealing would it be to your class to say something like, "I saw a cow this morning." Okay. And then ask, "What color was the cow?" Gets a little feedback. Some of them might say it was a Holstein cow. Some of them saw a Black Angus cow. Some of them saw a white cow or a black cow or a red cow or whatever. Guess what? You've just been discussing adjectives, and then you can say, that's exactly what we're going to talk about today, is how to make speech come alive through the use of a term called adjectives. You see? You can introduce these ideas without coming across as saying, "Oh, it's just something else we got to do." Be excited about it yourself. Be creative in the way you introduce it, and then come out that way. You can start off devotions or anything else you do with a story or a dramatic illustration. greetings is fine. Yeah, do a greeting. I greet you this morning in the precious name of Jesus. And then go on and talk about how you'd rather not be up here and it's my turn again. And that, no, no. Talk about things such as right away, go into a story or some kind of attention step to draw them in. I heard a speaker just this past Sunday, one of our preachers, he started off with, greetings in Jesus' name. How would you respond? Or no, he didn't ask that. It was something to the effect of have you ever tried to start a lawnmower that had water mixed in the gas? Wow, he brought us right into whatever he's going to be saying. And then he introduces, after he gives us those word pictures, then he introduced then very quickly what he wanted to actually talk about. First, words are important. In J, especially in admonition and exhortation, when you need to speak to somebody, even this applicable, if you're confronting or dealing with an erring brother or sister, you need to deal with him or her, confront his or her sin or whatever, or deal with a student that needs admonition and correction, be frank and forthright and honest. Avoid insinuations and hints and riddles. Do you know that in good relationships, there's never a bush? In good relationships, there is no bush to beat around. There just aren't bushes. Good relationships are on a bushless plain. And if you're going to nurture relationships and deal with things in confrontation and admonition and creative discipline, don't beat around the bush. Be frank, forthright, honest, meek, and gentle. Because I've already had somebody insinuate, perhaps, that there's something that he has a problem with me. And I just wish, well, could you tell me what it is? Could you just tell me? And then he might speak in a riddle, and it just, what did he say? What did he really want? What was the burden of his heart? Did he have a burden? Was he told by someone to come talk to me? And this is not really what he wants to do, or this isn't really genuine from his heart. Be frank, be sincere, be honest, just be frank. It may hurt to be received like that, but it will quickly heal, and it will heal a lot quicker than insinuations and riddles and those kind of things. Be frank and forthright and direct. Let's go on to L. Space fillers are time wasters. Space fillers are time wasters. Eliot said, blessed is a man who, having nothing to say, abstains from giving wordy evidence of the fact. If you have something to say, say it well, but only if you do. I'm reminded of my grandma, my grandpa. My grandma Kaufman was a talker. I once wrote a little poem about her that grandpa thinks, and then he speaks. No, let's see. Let me get this right. I didn't write this down. Grandpa thinks, and then he speaks. Grandma speaks. No, Grandpa thinks, and then he speaks. All his words are gentle, meek. Grandma speaks, and then she thinks. She blushes purple pink. And I remember the times when, in a lull in conversation, Grandma would look over at Grandpa Levi and say, Levi, sock epas! Or, say something. Levi, say something. She just thought that somebody had to be talking all the time. Not so with Grandpa. He was okay with just being quiet. And air didn't have to be filled with conversation all the time. So if you have something to say, be worthwhile. Have it be worthwhile. M, pause only for emphasis. Have you ever had the idea that sometimes when a speaker makes a point, he gets really into it and he makes a point and then he pauses because he has to find out where he was again. And it gets uncomfortably warm all of a sudden. You know, where is he taking us? Oh, what's happening here? Is he uncomfortable with what he just said? Pause only for emphasis. only for emphasis. N, this is a big quagmire, and this is something that I just think God's people need to be aware of. Do give credit where credit is due. How can we when I teach at a Bible school or something, or have given an outline or a handout or something like that, how can you take that to your home church and then use it for your devotions without giving credit to the source? That happens, and it should not. It's unethical and illegal. May I say that frankly? It's unethical and illegal to use someone else's stuff for your own, both written and orally. It's illegal. It's plagiarism is the technical word for it. Give credit where credit is due. Okay, and O, get feedback. Ask for your quirks and quips to be identified. Go to a trusted source, someone that is skilled or experienced at public speaking or could give you a constructive critique. Ask them how you're doing. Invite someone into your classroom. Invite someone to your classroom for the sole purpose of evaluating your presentation. Why not? You want to get better at what you do, don't you? Sure, get someone to do that. And these are not on your handouts, but just a couple other quick points. Use natural gestures. Natural gestures. You wouldn't want to say, when you're giving the story of Moses going through the Red Sea, and then suddenly there was a path through the mighty Red Sea. No, you would say, a path through the mighty Red Sea. Use natural gestures. See, sometimes speakers will want to emphasize something, and they know they need to use gestures, but it's not natural. It's kind of forced, and it looks awkward. So use what comes naturally to you. A good speaker will speak almost as much with his hands as with his mouth, to make it come alive and give you give it heart and emphasis. And then another point yet before we go to dealing with fear and using it for effectiveness is use illustrations and examples to make it come alive. And as much as possible, use it from your own experience. From your own experience, make it come alive. Now, dealing with fear, using fear for effectiveness. Someone has said, I think it was Roscoe Drummond, said, the mind is a wonderful thing. It starts working the minute you're born, and it never stops until you get up to speak in public. You know what we're talking about? Get up to speak in public and all of a sudden just kind of it drains about as fast as the blood in your face just goes out. Dr. Jeff Myers gives 6 points for conquering your fear of public speaking. The first is identify the source of your anxiety. Evaluate it honestly. Identify the source of your anxiety and evaluate it honestly. He suggests writing it down. What specifically makes you uncomfortable in the situation? Is it fear of what people will think? How will they respond? Am I saying something worthwhile? Identify the actual fear. Be specific and write it down. And by the way, writing it down, when you do write it down, it won't look as big anymore because it's been reduced to a few little lines. And it may look a bit ridiculous too. Why am I scared of how they're going to take it? If it's God's truth, it's okay. I don't have to be concerned with that. So, it helps you to identify the source of anxiety. Number two, explain your fears in a positive way. Not like, I'm not qualified to do this. I'm no good at this. Others are so much better than I am. I am genetically predisposed to failure because my dad wasn't a good speaker either. You heard of things like that? Have you ever thought things like that? Rather, perhaps I haven't done, explain it positively, perhaps I haven't done well with this in the past, and I wonder what it would take for me to become more effective. And I'm going to pray about this. I'm going to seek the Lord about it. How can I improve? I really don't feel confident and I desire to. I need to deal with this. So that's explaining your fears in a positive way. Number three, focus on the audience, not yourself. As we mentioned before, it's not about you anyway. It's not. If you have something to give, it's for their sake and for the glory of God. It's not, if you feel sincere and if you have a sincere desire to reach them and their hearts with God's unchanging truth, then you're thinking about them and your focus will be off yourself. So don't think about how you feel. Think on the expectations, the concerns, and the characteristics of the audience. What do they need? What should they hear? What should they receive? What does God want to say to them? What should they experience and learn? And remember, too, that perfect love casts out fear. If you love the audience in a perfect way, it casts out the fear. Number four, we spoke of this. No, we didn't. Invest time in preparation. I guess we skipped over that one, but that's obvious. If you have spent adequate time in preparing yourself, it eliminates, it helps to deal with fear. Number five, speak only on subjects you care about. Not what's convenient, not only what's convenient, not going back to the Thompson Chain Reference Bible and getting a little outline there and just, you know, kind of going over it. You know, it might not be something you really care about. And guess what? It's going to be obvious. They're going to know. You don't really care about this. You just picked up something that was convenient and you were able to go for it. So speak only about subjects you care about. What really gets you mad? What gets you going? What gets you excited? What do you want to see happen? Believing deeply about what you say. And finally, number six, develop a sense of mission. Believe that their lives will be changed if they accept and receive what God is going to say through you. Even in the classroom, their lives will be changed if it becomes a part of them. Are they getting it? That sense of mission, are they getting it? That burden, that unction, that passion for conveying what you believe is important for them. And then in B there, a thought. Use fear for effectiveness. Guess what? I was nervous about giving this topic. I really had the qualms. One of the ways that I deal with qualms, and Dr. Jeff Myers encourages this too, is use the adrenaline you get from your fear to be expressive, to be vibrant, to move around a little bit, to raise your voice, to be energetic a little bit, not just stand back here and grip and drill your fear into the corners of the lectern. Move around. Use your fear for effectiveness. And finally, the top secret for overcoming fear is embrace it. Embrace it. And the reason I say that, and this is also from Dr. Jeff Myers partly, a thought from him, is because God's strength is made perfect in your weakness. God's strength is made perfect in your weakness. And in my weakness, God's strength is made perfect in it. When I'm weak, then am I strong. You see, when we're weak, when we are not confident in ourselves, that's when God can be strong. So this is an encouragement to trust, to just yield. When I'm weak, then am I strong. Embrace the fear. Don't be afraid of fear itself. Move through it. You know what? The quality of courage is not the absence of, there's also Dr. Jeff Myers. Courage is not the absence of fear, but responding rightly in spite of it. Moving through it and using fear effectively by letting God make the most of it. And I wanted to use the example of Moses. We won't have time, but I'd just like for you to contemplate on this. What kind of excuses did Moses give when God called him to lead the children of Israel, to be a leader, which would include speaking to them? I can't do it. I'm not eloquent. Just think about this a little bit and see how many recorded words and what portion of Scripture are the recorded words of Moses. Remember, God kind of assayed his fear a little bit by saying, I'll get Aaron to be your spokesperson. How much of the Scripture did Aaron speak? You see any recorded words of Aaron in giving the law and everything that God wanted to say to the people? No. I think Moses ended up embracing his fear because he knew who God was with his fear. He learned to know God through his fear. A quality of connecting, convincing communication is to quit on time. I failed. 3 minutes passed. Lord bless you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.